All right, it's Dave Plyer, 720 WGN, and welcome into our WGN radio special, Totally the 80s, Part 2. The 1980s were a revolutionary decade in pop culture that still influences today's entertainment. The era was marked by incredible creativity and innovation in music, TV, and the movies. Iconic new music genres, popular TV shows, and blockbuster movies emerged. From the diverse music scene and daring fashion statements to the cinematic masterpieces and big shows on the small screen, the 80s celebrated creativity and individualism like never before. Now tonight we're going to highlight two film classics of the 1980s, Airplane with Robert Hayes and Ferris Bueller's Day Off with Alan Ruck. In television, we'll celebrate the Wonder Years with Chicago's own Fred Savage, family ties with another of Chicago's very own, Michael Gross, and One Day at a Time with Valerie Bertinelli. We'll sprinkle some 80s music in, too, with Martha Davis from The Motels. Now, first up, voted one of the 10 funniest movies ever made by the American Film Institute, is Airplane with my pal Robert Hayes, who played the iconic role of Ted Stryker. There are puns, there are pratfalls, double entendres, references to film and TV and popular commercials, random acts of silliness and absurdity. And now Airplane riffs on the Airport series, particularly Airport 1975 and Irwin Allen disaster films like The Poseidon Adventure and The Towering Inferno. And the movie's creative team, David and Jerry Zucker and Jim Abrahams, are second to none. It's been listed as one of the top 10 funniest movies ever made by the American Film Institute. The movie featured Leslie Nielsen, Lloyd Bridges, Peter Graves, Robert Stack, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Lorna Patterson, and the leads of the film, Julie Haggerty, and our guest tonight, who played Ted Stryker, Robert Hayes. Bob, thanks for hanging out with us tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure.
What was your first impression when you read the script? Did you think they were out of their mind, or did you just laugh your ass off?
Yeah, I laughed. I mean, I was on a plane flying from L.A. back to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and with Donna Peskov, that I was doing a series called Angie with at the time. And I was reading the script because I had a meeting the following, I think it was Tuesday, and we flew back just for the weekend for the TV station. It had changed from NBC to ABC. It was the oldest TV station west of the Mississippi, and so that was a big deal for ABC to get that.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
So we had Howard Cosell and all kinds of ABC people, and they flew us all back there.
That's cool.
And I read the script on the plane, and there was something on every page that made me laugh out loud. It was just so funny.
The audition, you know, what I've heard you say before, you know, they pretty much. Obviously they were looking at other people, but they pretty much liked you right off the bat. They said, yeah, no, this is the guy.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was great. I had an agent in my agent's office. He brought in a new agent named Beth Voigt, and she'd worked with Howard Koch on something, I don't know what, before, but she knew him. So she called him up and said, Howard, I got your guy. I got your Ted Stryker, because they'd been looking everywhere, and they couldn't, all over the country, and they couldn't find Ted or Elaine. And so they said, well, bring him in. So she brought me in, and they liked me, and I liked them. We all got along great, and they liked my reading. And then I got to screen test with Julie, and that was really lucky for me. I think for both of us, it just looked like you could see the pair, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And so it was great. It was just, talk about winning the lottery all the way along, you know. I lucked out having Beth know him and call up and having us all get along so well and then liking my reading and then being able to work with her. I mean, it was just wonderful. And then you got all the other people that you got to work with. Bob Stack, I had gotten to know him before when I was a guest star on the TV series he was doing called Most Wanted. And he was one of the neatest guys I ever met. I love him. And Lloyd Bridges, Lloyd was great. Peter Graves was wonderful, and Leslie was nuts.
But that was his first dramatic role. I mean, people don't know that. Like, our first comedic role, he was a dramatic actor for all of his life.
Yeah, dramatic stuff and also light comedy. But he wasn't, you know, like the one of the casting people. I don't know who it was, but one of the casting people, when the boys called up and said, we want Leslie Nielsen. And they said, Leslie Nielsen? That's who you hire the night before you're going to shoot because you can't get anyone else.
Wow.
And they said, that's who we want. And you know, and then later, I don't know, I'm sure that all the people, you know, involved with it take credit for it. But it was the guys. It's who they wanted. They wrote it. They had their vision. They knew what they wanted. And, you know, even though they got blowback from all levels. But Mike Eisner did, like the boy said, he had some great ideas, and they did follow along with a lot of the things that he said, and he was right. And they wanted to do it black and white, but he said, and they said, we're really adamant about that. And he said, well, I wish you the best. I hope you do make a really good picture. You're just not going to make it here.
Oh, he was like, wow.
Make color or you make it somewhere else. But yeah, I tell you what, it's Friday, so you go think about it in the weekend, and you come back, and we'll talk next week. So he said, and I want it to be a jet plane, not a prop plane. So they finally said, okay, we got a chance. We might as well do it. Let's make these concessions. And so they made it color, and they made it a jet plane. But they got him back by making prop sounds.
Gotcha.
And that's a joke.
So yeah, right.
Laughed and said, okay, all right, you got me. But it was very funny. And that's another part of the joke of the whole film. So they're just amazing. Those guys are just amazing.
Did they seem apprehensive at all? Like, again, like, and I've heard Peter Graves was like, what? The script is garbage. Like, you know, in the beginning.
Oh, it was the worst thing he'd ever read. And he threw it down, and his daughters. Yeah. And his agent said, no, come on, you got to look at this again. And I don't know, Lloyd was a little unsure about what is going on. Leslie had always wanted to do that, but he was a little apprehensive about, it's kind of like what he said, he walked up to the door, but it was the boys that pushed him through. So he had wanted to, and he was doing things a little too broad, and they finally got him to, no, we want that sonorous voice of yours. And he got everyone to understand, we want this to be serious. The first guy that they thought of was Bob Stack. Hmm. And they just thought, when they saw this and they thought about doing it as a film, they thought, Robert Stack, Elliot Ness. Mm-hmm. They wanted that thing. And he got it. Lloyd, it took a while for him to get it, and then when he finally got it, he ran with it, and he really took to it. But the guys were very smart that they wanted everyone to play it straight. Do it straight. Let the audience laugh.
Yeah.
When you're laughing, you know, it's like when you laugh, you're laughing for the audience. If you're laughing at yourself when you're up on stage, the audience just sits there and watches it because you're already laughing for them. They don't have to laugh.
Well,
he's taking it away.
Well, and here's the thing I read that I didn't know is the movie was loosely based around a 1957 drama called The Zero Hour. And I know there was other things like From Here to Eternity and Saturday Night Fever and everything, but The Zero Hour was kind of a...
Not very loose. Not very loose. It was very, very, very much based on Zero Hour.
Okay, all right, okay.
To the point when they said... Because they taped it. One night they used to set the tape recorder going, and they would tape the movies, midnight movies.
Oh, I love that.
And then they would look at all the commercials so they could make fun of the commercials, you know, do, you know, satires of the commercials during their show.
Yeah.
The Kentucky Fried Theater show that they did. And then they saw this and they started to speed through it to get to the commercial and said, wait a second. And they started watching it and they said, oh my God, this is great. And so they started doing, they wrote the screenplay. And then when they finally got the go ahead, they said, to their agent, well, we kind of based it sort of on this thing, Zero Hour. Do you think we need to get the rights to it? And the agent watched Zero Hour and looked at the script and said, no, you definitely get the rights to it. So they looked all over and they couldn't find, they got half the rights, but they couldn't find them anywhere. And it was getting down to the wire. And they had to have the rights, but they couldn't know, where are they? And then finally, it was like one little guy back in the copyright room or whatever said, huh? Oh, the rights? Yeah, they're right over here. The other half of the rights were there at Paramount the whole time, buried back in the archive somewhere.
Wow.
Because those things, you know, they'll tend to, somebody will get the rights and then they'll just stick it in a stack of paper somewhere and it's kind of lost.
Sure.
Filed away or something.
Dave Blyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to actor Robert Hayes, star of the blockbuster movie Airplane. So
I love that guy. I just love that guy.
He's a good guy. He is a really good guy. You know,
I tell you, every single person was aces in that. I mean, they were all so great. And Lorna Patterson, Lorna is unbelievably talented. She's so great. And Julie, I can't even imagine anybody else playing that, but Julie, she's so incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And here's something I found out recently is too. You were playing a pilot. You were a licensed pilot at that time, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Look at you. Did you keep that up? I mean,
My dad was he was a fighter pilot in the Marine Corps, and he was in World War II, Korea, Vietnam. He's a long time. He was in, and I said afterwards it came to the screening and at the DGA, and so that was fun for me, you know. And by the way, there was a person right in front of me that was howling, and I almost reached up and tapped her on the shoulder and said, "Hey, do you mind?" I mean, it was so loud. It was like, God, man, I want to hear it. And I'm glad I didn't, because it was a very famous actress.
Oh, was it really?
Yes. So, but anyway, I asked my dad afterwards, "So what'd you think of my flying?" And he kind of looked at me like, But they laughed.
Yeah,
they laughed.
Gotcha.
And Bob Stack was so, they came to visit on the set, and Bob Stack was so great. He said, "Well, John, it's nice to meet you," and or Colonel, maybe he said Colonel Hayes, maybe to my dad.
That's cool.
He said, "It's really nice to meet you." He said, "You know, the way I look at it is, Bob was a guest star on my show, and now I'm a guest star on his show."
Hello.
It was just so neat of him to say that.
Yeah. No, but, absolutely.
But anyway, it was magic. Absolute magic.
You know, when you played it straight, you know, even Leslie to a degree played it straight. Was that the kind of direction you were given, or did you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's what they wanted.
Yeah.
That's what they wanted. You know, the way I talk about it is there's a little astral projection of yourself, especially if you're on stage, but it's with film too. And the little guy, or whoever, you know, girl for a girl, or guy for guys, is just kind of standing next to you. And with some of these guys, some of the people that do comedy, it's kind of like they're looking at the audience saying, "Hey, huh? What do you think? Huh? That's funny, huh? Isn't it? Hey, that's funny." But with us, my little astral projection was looking at the audience and saying, "What are you laughing about? This is serious stuff." Which made them laugh even harder, and that's the brilliance of the guys. In school, and I was in, you know, in regional theater and everything. That's what I really liked. I had this frown in my gut when I was doing comedy. I had a smile in my gut when I was doing heavy stuff.
When you were doing the Saturday Night Fever stuff, yeah, that was you kept that face like, and I know it you rehearsed for weeks to get that just right. But that was, you know, that was a lot of emotion, a lot of craziness, a lot of physicalness in that scene, and your face just didn't change through the whole thing. It was fantastic.
It was so fun. We had, we had Joe. We had two guys, Lester Wilson and Joey. Ooh, I can't think of Joe's last. Flanagan, I think.
Okay.
And anyway, they were our choreographers. And Joe is a choreographer, I think, with Disney. He was sort of like a staff choreographer that helped on all their movies and musicals and all the shows that they would do. And Lester was apparently he was the guy on Saturday Night Fever that gave the feel and style and thing that gave Johnny a lot of the moves and, you know, what's the guy's name that they always give the credit to? Is it kind of Italian name, I think. I can't think of it right off the bat.
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah.
But Lester was this guy, just this delicious move, this black guy that was wonderful. He moved great. And he gave us a lot of the feeling about that stuff. And so the both of them worked with us for 2 weeks, I think. And when we got there... Yeah. And this was one of those times when I was working on Angie, and then I'd go over there, and we would shoot that, and I'd go back, and then I'd come back over. And I mean, we only had a certain amount of time in that bar scene, and then we had to move on, because it was a small budget.
Yeah, 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 it was like $3.5 million. Yeah, I saw that. $3.5 million to make, $83 million, though, it made at the end of the day.
Oh, it's made more than that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And when it opened in 1980, it was the fourth largest blockbuster hit back then. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's made way more than that. Absolutely.
Yeah, but like they said, they made the money so fast, they made it faster than the studio could hide it. So, you know, that's the old joke is
yeah,
they're always hiding the money so well. They say that they're hoping that this year, Gone with the Wind is finally going to go into profit. So,
nice. We're talking to Robert Hayes from Airplane, and there's more when we come back on 720 WGN. State Plyer here on 720 WGN. We're talking to Robert Hayes, Ted Stryker of the blockbuster movie Airplane. At that time, 1980, yeah. I was heading into eighth grade. And I will tell you, I'm just telling you. And I'm just telling you, though, that going that whole summer, going that entire school year into my freshman year, my sophomore year, I don't think I've ever repeated so many lines from a movie, maybe Goodfellas down the road, but from a movie than Airplane. I mean, just, and today, you could still say,
I am serious. Don't call me Shirley. And that, more than anything else, led to my drinking problem. And, you know, the hospital, what is it?
Yeah.
You know, the cockpit, what is it? Sure. Oh, yeah. They're just, they're constant.
Yeah, they absolutely are. Here, I've got some fun facts here. I want to throw these by you. And David Letterman and Bruce Jenner read for the part of Ted Stryker. Is that right? Is that valid?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Letterman, they told me that Letterman didn't, well, I watched the show when they were guests on the show, and unbeknownst to him, they brought his screen test, and he wasn't very happy about it. He doesn't like, apparently, from watching his show, he doesn't like to have people pull something on him.
Yeah,
he likes to pull stuff on people, but he doesn't like to be embarrassed or surprised or whatever, so, but I guess that kind of embarrassed him a little, but they're huge fans, but they realize that he's really not an actor, he's a comedian.
Yeah, right.
And he didn't really want to do it. His agents said, well, you know, come on, David, you got to do it, but he didn't really want to.
Gotcha.
But he was funny. He was very, very funny. But when you say, okay, hey, cut two, take two, let's do it again. Well, then you got to say the same things again, and it's a script. And he likes to kind of go off.
Yeah,
cuff.
Yeah.
So
most
he was
comedians
very,
don't like rehearsing.
He was relieved because he didn't want to have to do that.
As I say, most comedians don't like to rehearse. They want it fresh, and they want it in front of an audience. And to do it five times loses its luster. You're absolutely right.
Oh, you do it the second time, it's like, well, wait a minute, they already heard the jokes.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. The Mustang in one of the scenes was owned by you. Yeah.
My Mustang Sally.
Mm-hmm.
I drove to work, and that was a 66 Mustang convertible, and Howard said, we need your car, because it was a convertible, and they were doing the rear screen projection, so he said we needed that. So Sally got, $35 a day, and that was 2 days, so I got $70.
Look at that.
It was a big, big money, I tell you.
Yeah, but what a great car, too. And just as an aside here, don't you also have like a Volkswagen bus that you bought and still have it?
A 66 Volks bus. I got it in 68 and still have him. Buster, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I lived in him for a couple of years while I was in all this stuff in college and discovering, this acting thing. And I had a job. There were a lot of student jobs, you know, like student janitors, clean the classrooms. The area that I cleaned was the gym. So I would just take my shower while I was cleaning the gym.
Smart.
So it worked out great.
Some other facts here. This is the movie that killed Ethel Merman. This was her last. This was her last performance when she played herself. She was only 72, by the way. I mean, she wasn't
really
ancient.
Oh, my God.
I know, right? Because, I mean, not our 72 today, but she was only 72 years old when she made that appearance, but that was apparently her last.
We did her in.
The part of the Jive Lady was written with Harriet Nelson in mind, who played in The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, but she turned it down because she didn't like the adult language in the script.
She was worried about that. I met her afterwards. I met her. Actually, it was at a screening, I think, of Angie or something like that. She was there, I believe. Anyway, I met her, and she was the sweetest lady. My God, she was wonderful. And she was so, like, oh, I loved that so much, but I'm so sorry I didn't do it. I just was so worried about that language. And now, but now afterwards, she was really, really sorry she didn't do it.
I bet.
But Barbara Billingsley, Barbara was fantastic.
Ah, she swears like a sailor. She doesn't care.
Yeah, well, I kind of understood that afterwards. But it's very funny because, you know, the Beeves' mom,
yeah,
you know, and Leave It to Beaver, and she could make a sailor blush. So it was pretty cute. But she was so good in it. And Al White, Al and Norm were the two black guys, the black jive.
Mm-hmm.
And they went up to the boys and said, do you mind if we change this dialogue? Because the dialogue was, yo, she mofo, she mofo,
yeah,
she mofo.
Yeah.
That was it.
Written by white
and
guys.
And they said, please, yeah, please, we're three white Jewish guys from Milwaukee. What do we know? We don't know anything. Please.
You're right. It's true.
And so they wrote their own scene.
Legendary.
And then when Jim came up to me at the end of one day and he said, okay, we're going to shoot the scene. I think it was the Japanese general coming in, Harry Carey, and also I think it was with Jesse, the guy that played the Indian guy with the turban,
yep,
and
yep,
doused himself.
Yep.
And for those scenes,
yeah,
he said, we need more dialogue. We need more dialogue. So write something tonight. And I just freaked out. I went, what? Write something. Holy. And then I said, calm down, Bob, calm down. And I thought, I bore people to death. Okay, I can be boring. It's okay. And so I went home and I wrote all this stuff, and a bunch of it got in. But it was just me rambling. So
It was one of the best scenes. And no, it was, because he had no language. He had no lines whatsoever. It was all you. Oh, that's very funny. That is. I know, right? You're still laughing.
He was so wonderful. Jesse was so great. But the poor guy, I kept having to take that dramatic pause.
Yeah.
About, do I go to the cockpit? You know, what is it? Well, it's a little room where the pilot sits, but that's not important right now. And I just kind of look, and I think, well, oh, gosh. And I'm thinking, well, geez, should I go? And I turn to him, and he's nodding like, yes, please. But the whole time, the match is burning down, and it burned his fingers. We had did like five takes on that. And he was moving his, every time he moved his fingers, if you looked at all the takes, you'd see how he's holding the match.
Yeah.
The next take, he's holding it way down further. And by the last take we were doing, he was holding the tiniest little
bit
at the end of the match, because it just kept burning all
the way
down. I got to
watch that again. I got to see that again. That's awesome. That's what here's what something I love about you, Bob, and I know this about you. You know, there's, you know, so many people run away from iconic roles that might have first defined them in the early parts of their careers, but you have always, always, always worn this film as you're laughing still at these lines today as a badge of honor, because it is that good.
I love it. I love it, and it never interfered with anything. Like when I did Hamlet with Spielberg, it never interfered with that.
Yeah. Right.
It wasn't that popular. Maybe you never heard of it, but you know, it was what he was hoping would be a big blockbuster, but it kind of flopped.
Yeah, but I mean,
but
you're proud of it. No, I know, but you're proud of this. But you're proud of this film, and that's what I love.
I tell you, it was, aside from the birth of my son and my family, my folks, my family. Aside from that, I mean, this was the greatest thing ever in my life, and I got to meet the boys. I got to meet Julie and Howard and Lorna and all the people. You know, I mean, it was just, and to work with them, and every day you'd come to work, you couldn't wait to get there.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it was like, I only want to go home because I'm tired, but I don't really want to go home. I want to keep going.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was so fun. It was just, I mean, if you like going to work and laughing your tail off every day.
That's right.
But you can't laugh. You got to keep a straight face.
You got to keep a straight face. Exactly. Exactly. Well, here's what I love. Apparently, at some point, this movie's going to be back in theaters for a weekend. And I know it was postponed because of what's going on in our world today. But it should be coming back to theaters at least for a weekend or two. And I know there's a new Blu-ray coming out in the Paramount Presents line. It's going to be a limited edition Blu-ray steelbook. And that's coming out on July 21st, so hopefully you're still getting some checks. Hopefully you're getting checks from this.
Great. Well, I didn't know that until you just told me, so that's nice.
Yeah, that's right.
Paramount is not that communicative. But, you know, I mean, I was thinking about, you were talking about the dialogue still,
yeah.
All the lines that are still. There's a thing called Cameo where people call up, you know, they buy a cameo from you, and I do those. And
do you really?
Every single time they're saying, can you do, you know, surely you can't be serious. I'm just serious. Don't care. Can you do that? Or can you do a line from Airplane? Or can you do... Every single time. It's so cute. It's really, really fun.
Dave Plyer's radio special, Totally the 80s, continues.
Valerie Bertinelli has been in the public eye for nearly a half a century, starring in hit TV shows One Day at a Time, Touched by an Angel, Hot in Cleveland, hosting an Emmy Award-winning Food Network program, Valerie's Home Cooking, and writing best-selling books. Behind the curtain of her on-screen persona, Valerie's life has not been an easy ride, especially when it comes to her own self-image and self-worth. Here is Valerie Bertinelli. And to talk about her new book, Enough Already, Learning to Love the Way I Am Today, is Valerie Bertinelli. Hi, Valerie.
Hello.
Hello to you. I'm so glad you're joining us today. You know, I will tell you, this book was most likely a pretty cathartic journey to write. You say this book is about letting go of certain behaviors that no longer serves me, recognizing it never did, and trying to find new ways of channeling my thoughts and emotions. It's really about letting go and loving who you are right now, isn't it?
It is, and I'm hoping that that message will embed itself in everybody about themselves, that it really is about letting go and just accepting yourself for who you are, flaws and all. You are perfect just the way you are. I just think if more of us would just accept the good and the bad and the ugly, that we could move on and be more productive as human beings in this world.
No question. No question. And by the way, right after the foreword, you write in so many words before you start reading, go make this snack. And you throw out a recipe, a hot spinach and crab dip, and it made me laugh. I was like, okay, I'll go make a snack before I get started. You know, it's a big
yeah,
part of what you're doing.
I started off loving food, and I'm not going to not love food any longer just because I don't like the way I have used or abused it in the past. It's still love for me, and I wanted to share some recipes that kind of relate to different stories in the book.
Yeah, but what goes better than with conversation is a little food, right?
Right, of course.
Yeah. You open talking about your first husband, Eddie Van Halen, stopping by the house to talk to you and actually having some of that dip. And you reflected on that first time you and Ed met and a little about how Wolfie got into music himself. But you talk about the relationship that seemed less complicated after you divorced, yet in that moment, you wanted to hug him and when you greeted him, but you really didn't know how. You'd known that Ed's second marriage wasn't going well, neither was yours, but you didn't want to send the wrong message, yet it was something you regretted not doing. Do you find that those types of moments happen a lot where you second guess yourself in those situations?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. And I'm here to tell you and help anybody through it that, you know, treat people the way you want to be treated, of course, but also as if you're never going to see them again. We don't know when our last moment is going to be with someone. So I know that I've never regretted hugging someone or telling someone I love them. That's what could be wrong with that? And I know that I have regretted if I haven't done that, if I haven't let someone know how I really feel about them. So I would encourage anybody to really treat people the way you want to be treated and as if you're not going to see them again.
I like that you say that because I know you're a hugger, so am I, and it's been hard during the pandemic to not be able to reach out and do that because it's a sincere form of love and compassion for somebody when you see them. And, you know, when you had invited Eddie to dinner and really wanted it to be different and kind of let everything else go, which is not always easy. You know, this is a situation where you knew time was ticking a little bit, and that's not always the case. You said, you know, you never know when the next time you're going to see somebody, so you might as well embrace that moment as it was. But in this specific situation, you kind of knew you had to spend as much time as you could before he was gone.
True. I sort of knew that, but I wouldn't let myself believe it. I really, truly naively believe that Ed would get through this. Even when my brother was telling me, no, it's bad, and Wolfie was like, Mom, we don't know how much longer we have. I'm like, that's crazy. Your dad always gets better.
Yeah.
This is going to be fine. I really believe that. But then it just hit me, you know, those last few days, it was like, fuck. This is really bad, and I'm going to miss you, and I wish we had done it better. We'll do it better next time. And, oh, it's so hard.
Yeah, you know, and I know he confided in you, but you really wanted to make sure he knew you were there for him, and that was really important.
Oh, very important to me, yeah, because I know that he had a lot of regrets about the way he had treated me or Wolfie or any of the things that he had done what he believed was wrong. I just wanted him to know that it's all okay now, that how much I loved him, and I knew how much he loved me. I knew, you know, all the stuff just didn't even matter anymore, all the ways we treat each other. I mean, I know that he was really angry at me for a few years after I left, and I just wanted him to know that it's all good now. It, you know, that's really is water under the bridge. It's not worth holding on to.
But you know as well as I do, there is no marriage, there is no relationship on this planet that's perfect. And if someone leads you to believe that, there's something behind it. There's just no relationship and no marriage that goes through swimmingly.
No. But I think that's what we are as humans. We need to go through hardships so that we can get to the other side of them. We're here to learn. We're here to learn how to be more compassionate, how to be more kind, how to be more grateful. And I think you need to have rough times so that you know how to work through them with as much kindness as you possibly can.
So I grew up watching you. I mean, we're pretty close to the same age, but you were a very, I'm sure you've heard this 1,000 times, very early crush in my very early years. And you were America's sweetheart, right? I mean, that's what you were always known as, but that's really a lot of pressure and big words to live up to in the public eye, isn't it?
I'm grateful that I didn't know
how
big it was. I mean, I'm finding all this out now, which is nice, but we didn't have social media back then, so that I wasn't bombarded with that. I was just doing my job and doing it to the best of my ability. But it's really nice to find out, you know, at this age that I meant something to people.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, through your entire career, you did. I mean, you've done so much. But you mention in the book that nothing is drearier or more unproductive than that well-worn path from my bed to the scale. And yet, it's the rare day that I can avoid that route. I mean, we all do that. And I need someone to put up a detour sign, you write. But that has been an ongoing story and struggle to be that perfect person, right?
Right, and there is no such thing as perfection. As a human being, we can't be perfect. It's, you know, we can strive to be as good as we can possibly be, but there is no perfection. Otherwise, why are we here? But when I finished writing the book, I stopped getting on the scale, and I haven't been on the scale since I finished. And surprise, surprise, my jeans still fit, so I haven't, you know, awesome. Changed that much. All I've changed is my attitude, because now I'm not looking at a number that's going to depress me for the rest of the day, because the number was couldn't ever be low enough. When it was low, I wanted it lower. And if the number was high, I was like, well, that's it. My life is over. I might as well just never go out again. People are going to judge me. Now I'm like, you know what? I can start the morning a lot better not having one more thing depress me.
Yeah, and I know you want people to learn this stuff from this book, because, I mean, it made me think about things, too. Like, man, we put ourselves under so much pressure, don't we?
Yeah. And it needs to be easier than that. I mean, yes, there are challenges in life, and yes, there's going to be difficulties, but we need to be softer and kinder to ourselves so that we can be softer and kinder to others. It starts from within. There's no getting around it.
And you talk about your journey, by the way, on the small screen, you know, 1975 cast as Barbara Cooper, but you literally grew up in front of the entire country, and Bonnie Franklin was like a second mom to you, but she told you at some point to be true to yourself. And that's something is really important to embrace, because it's not always easy to do that.
No, and when she told me that, it didn't sink in. It took years for me, and I'm still working through that, being true to myself. What does that mean? Who am I? I'm still trying to figure out who I am. So I'm grateful for everything that she taught me, but I'm so thick-skulled. I just wish I'd learned lessons faster.
Thank you so much for sharing these stories with us today, Val. And I mean, really great insight on what you've learned so far in this journey. And I'm appreciative of your honesty, and hopefully it will help guide some others on their journey.
Oh, thank you so much. That was my intention.
Thanks, Val.
Thank you.
Dave Plyer's radio special, Totally the 80s, continues.
All right, Chicago's very own actor Michael Gross has been at this acting gig for over 40 years. Good Catholic boy, Cubs fan. You know him best for playing Michael J. Fox's father, Stephen Keaton, for 7 seasons on Family Ties. His longest running and highest profile role has been Burt Gummer in the Tremors franchise, having played the role for 30 years from the release of the original in 1990 to Tremors Shrieker Island in 2020. He's also a train enthusiast, which I want to talk to you about, and a grad of the University of Illinois Chicago, and has donated his papers to the UIC library. And to talk about it all, Michael Gross joins us in studio. Michael, welcome in.
Thank you. Great to be here. Great to be back in my hometown once again.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how often do you make it back here?
When my parents were alive, I was here several times a year.
Okay.
Now I still have some relatives and good friends and a sister, in fact, who lives in downtown Chicago.
Okay.
And I get here at least once a year.
Okay.
If not, you know, a little more sometimes. I'm drawn back always.
I love
always.
That. It's my beautiful
city. It's my place. Yeah.
What do the call letters WGN mean to you?
World's greatest newspaper.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. TV, radio, what memories do you have of radio and television here?
Oh, look, WLS was always a favorite of mine, particularly the high school years.
Yeah,
I was
at
Kelvin Park High School. On the northwest side is I graduated from there in 1965, and we were always listening. And in the earlier than that, listening to Dick Biondi and people like that. I have great. I don't forget whose network this was, but I have great memories of my father watched every night on television at 10 o'clock. Newscaster and weather forecaster Fahey Flynn.
Oh yeah, that's
and PJ Hoff.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
PJ Hoff, who was a weatherman, whose sign off was "This is PJ Hoff, the vice president in charge of looking out the window."
Classic legend.
I love that. I love that. I mean, here he was a weatherman, vice president in charge of looking out the window.
Yeah. Even my high school years, it was Surratt, who you just met,
Bob Surratt.
In his office, and John Landecker, John Records Landecker. My dad was listening to Wally Phillips and those morning guys here on GN, but legendary station, both TV and radio.
And of course, television when I was a kid. You know, there was always Garfield Goose and Fraser Thomas.
Yes.
Long before the days of Bozo, there was Garfield Goose. Bless him.
In the 50s.
Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. Sure. That's how far back I go. Burr Tilstrom.
Well, you look great. You look great. So you went to the University of Illinois Chicago and then Yale. So when did the acting bug hit you?
The acting bug hit me at the University of Illinois at Chicago. God bless him. When I walked into a study hall one day, because they did not have a theater on campus. I was in the first year, 1965, that the campus opened. They had not yet built a theater. And they were presenting something in a lecture hall, a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. It was free. The price was right. I had a couple of hours to kill between classes, so I went into this production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, sat there, watched it, and was mesmerized. First time Shakespeare had actually made sense to me in a funny way. And I thought, wow, this is really something. These people are good. This has come alive. This is extraordinary. The man who directed that production, William Raffeld, was a professor emeritus, now passed away, from the University of Illinois, Chicago. He became my first acting teacher, mentor, and about 40 years ago, the best man at my wedding.
Oh, get out of here.
Because I walked into a lecture hall to see a play.
Wow.
And Bill was about 8-10 years older than I. He was a student at Northwestern at the time. I was like 17 or 18. He was, you know, 27, 28, and pursuing a doctorate at Northwestern in theater. And he was teaching on the side here at U of I, and he was an amazing man, and I owe almost everything to him and the other good people at UIC who gave me the education I needed.
Amazing. Very different from the lecture hall you walked into yesterday or the day before yesterday.
You told me a story on the phone.
Oh, yes. I walked into that same lecture hall.
Yeah, that's cool. That must have been cool.
It was lecture hall A1, and I thought, oh, my God, here it is. Here's where I saw my first play. And there was a lecture going on, something in biology, something about the placenta, about which, by the way, I know very little. And I just stood in the back of the lecture hall, way up in the back, the last row at the entrance door, started to take a picture of the lecture hall for old time's sake. And the lecturer up there, who's, you know, I thought was so busy talking about the placenta, she wasn't noticing anything else.
Yeah.
She saw me up there, stopped the lecture, fixed me in her gaze and said, "Can we help you, sir?" And I, no, sorry. I'm just a visitor. I'm out of here. Bye, bye.
That's great.
Snapped my picture and got out. And I thought, okay.
But a nice flashback being back where you started, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And spent a lot of time with the students at UIC the last couple of days.
That's cool.
And was so inspired by them, their genius, some of them, some really wonderful raw talent, and some talent that's developed well beyond the raw stage and is looking very good, and just their passion for things, the same passion I shared. We're talking over 50 years ago. I got out of there I left there in 1970.
Okay.
Never to return full time to Chicago.
Yeah.
When I went to the School of Drama at Yale from 70 to 73 and never came back full time. But I saw those kids and I went, oh, wow, this is... And I rode the CTA there, just like old times. I was staying with friends in the Loop.
This last week, okay.
Yes, I rode the CTA, got off the Blue Line at Halsted.
Love that.
The way I used to all those years ago. I couldn't afford to go downstate. I didn't have the money for room and board, so went to a commuter campus and I thought, boy, nothing's changed.
Nothing.
Here I am getting off the subway again at Halsted.
Was it clean at least?
It was good.
Okay, good. Well, that was your beginning of your journey, and you said Yale. You did Yale, of course. Then you did some films, and you did some television films, but then Family Ties came along. You know, first really visible national role. How did that come about?
Just blind luck. I had been a theater snob in many ways. I thought I was going to end my days in regional theaters, Broadway, off-Broadway, and had begun to become part of that great repertory company that is New York City. I mean, a certain group of actors, you just kind of work all the time in town. And so I had done some Broadway, off-Broadway, television films that were being produced there. And Family Ties came along. And my agent said, this might be good for you to try. I said, I haven't done that much television. I'd done one failed pilot. And had missed getting another one, and I was just kind of, which was saying elsewhere, by the way.
Oh,
I didn't get on that, but it was just before the Family Ties. It was coming on the same year on NBC, as a matter of fact. And he said, well, let's try this one. I went, oh, okay, hippie father, sounds kind of interesting. And lo and behold, I found myself out in Los Angeles being tested for the pilot. They liked me, and the rest was history. And I thought, well, this will subsidize my theater career.
For a little while.
Is what I thought. Yeah, it'll fail. It won't get picked up, but I'll get a good chunk of money, and I can go do off-Broadway again for no money at all.
When you did the pilot, was it all the original cast that ended up being on the show?
It was the original cast.
Really?
Right. And because Meredith Baxter had made a nice name for herself on things like
Family,
Bridget Loves Bernie, and a number of other things, a number of television films. And, of course, I hadn't the slightest idea who she was because for years, during prime time, I was on a stage somewhere at 8 o'clock at night.
Right.
And so I watched daytime television.
Yeah,
that was my,
when you could. Yeah.
I would watch Phil Donahue in the morning.
And that from would, here, by the way.
That's what was my television watching. And I'd get home from the theater and shower and go to bed and didn't watch late night television. So I didn't know who anybody was. And I was extremely lucky because, as any actor will tell you, you follow the good work wherever it leads you. The good writing.
Yeah, that's very true.
And Family Ties had that in spades, and how fortunate I was.
Meredith Baxter, same birthday, I believe.
Same birthday as mine. Same birthday, same day, same year.
Wow.
Yes. She claims I'm older than she is.
Because
I was born at 3:10 a.m. in Chicago, and she was born in Los Angeles a few hours later, so she likes to lord that over.
Oh, yeah, you win.
Yeah. I'm the old guy.
You win. Great partnership on screen, but a great friendship off screen.
We have stayed close. As a matter of fact, we're floating the idea of coming back here to the University of Illinois and doing some sort of fundraiser for them.
Oh,
she
that's
and I.
Cool.
Among other things, I always say people are just curious to know if we're, one, still alive.
Yeah.
Okay. My, they've aged terribly, those two.
Oh, no.
No, there's a certain curiosity about us, which makes us perfect for something like this. And I've spoken to the university about this, and Meredith and I do this to each other. She'll say, will you help me do, I've got a, in January I'm doing a helping her do a benefit for a theater with in Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
So she said, will you come up to Santa Barbara and do this? I said, yeah, but you're going to owe me.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know what I got planned for her yet. But
she might now.
She's going to come back. And I said to the university, well, I said, we got to bring Meredith back here. She and I have to do something.
I love that.
Together.
I love that. And it pulls on heartstrings. To see like you two on stage. This is a show that generations grew up with.
We were pretty fortunate because, as I, you know, when we first began, it was one of the only three networks on television.
That's right. Yeah.
This was before Fox came along, right?
Yeah.
There was National Educational Television, finally became known as PBS.
Yeah.
But there wasn't much out there. And so it was big days. The last of the great sitcoms. When I stepped on the Paramount Studios in 1982, there was Laverne and Shirley, Happy Days, mm-hmm. Joni Loves Chachi, mm-hmm. Us, and a number of other things.
Yeah.
And you think, whoa, that really was sitcom land.
That was the last moment of that big time in sitcom history.
And where families could sit down together and watch the same show. Which
That's
is
very
kind
true.
Of interesting. And they still talk about that because I think there's been kind of, for lack of a better word, balkanization of television.
Yeah.
You have your device, your kids will watch their device in their room. You will watch television in this room. Somebody will be watching somebody else on their device in another place entirely. And you don't have the commonality of sitting down and watching the same thing together, which was that was kind of appointment TV, if you will.
We're talking to actor Michael Gross, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN.
Dave Fire, WGN.
We are talking to actor Chicago's own Michael Gross. Family ties Tremors on the big and small screen for over 40 years. Michael J. Fox, you saw him grow up pretty fast. I mean, that was his first real big time. I mean,
right.
Think about that.
The secret of my success.
The secret
I mean,
success,
how he just, it just ballooned. And, even before Back to the Future, there was this interesting niche he occupied as this non-threatening adolescent, you know, young man who was not John Travolta. He was a kind of relaxed, friendlier.
Yes.
And young girls were just like, oh, he's so nice. He's so sweet.
He was every kid.
I want to hug him.
Yeah.
And so that itself was a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Yeah. But even before Back to the Future.
You know, Family Ties was all about coming to the middle. You and Meredith playing very liberal characters. Michael's character, the ultimate conservative during the Reagan years. But there was always on the show a place to understand one another and hear people out, right?
Oh boy, yes.
Because that's gone.
I miss that.
Different times.
We could use a bit of that. Those were the days when Reagan, a staunch conservative, and Tip O'Neill, Irish and liberal as they come, two Irishmen could sit down in the Oval Office over a glass of Irish whiskey and talk things out and say, how do we do this, Ron? How do we do this, Tip? How do we make a compromise? How do we keep things moving forward?
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, I don't understand how some people in Congress today keep a marriage together, because one thing I know over 40 years of marriage is compromise is the word.
Yeah.
And how people don't compromise, I don't get it. You don't get anywhere without it. So I've learned that rule. I had to keep a marriage together because I wanted to keep a marriage together.
Yeah.
So I had to learn to do what I needed to do. And if you want the country to stay together, I say you compromise.
I would say that show did that. I was always surprised at the end of the show. Like, I mean, diabolically different thoughts, ideas, and they figured it out and they respected each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And the heart of it was, I'm going to tell you what it was too. Long before George Bush coined the word compassionate conservative, that's what Michael Fox was. That's what the character of Alex P. Keaton was, because his mind was always driving make a killing, you know, make the money, make things happen, get it done. But he was a product of his parents, and his parents' heart would always say, yeah, but do the right thing.
Yeah, pulling the, yeah.
And so he was an interesting character and a fascinating character because he was always in conflict with himself.
Yeah.
Which is to go to the, yeah. you know, go to the mat with toughness, but on the other hand,
compassion. Yeah.
And he had that character had that, and it made for great internal yeah. conflict, which is the basis of any good character you're going to find anywhere.
So well written. Yeah. Justine Bateman, Tini Others, Tracy Pollan, even Courtney Cox, pre-Friends. But right. there was a litany of guest stars, too. I was looking at the list.
Gina Davis?
Is she
on that list?
Gina Davis, River Phoenix, Martha Plimpton, Christina Applegate, Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Don't forget Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks, yes. Yeah, he was making the Paramount rounds on the shows at that time when they were trying to get him up there a little bit. Yeah. But yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it was a wonderful group. And with just classic people coming in, good stage people who were soon to become, other things on television yeah. and film. But we had Brownie McGee there once. Brownie wow. McGee, the jazz musician.
Wow.
I mean, I was glad we had good people there. And I was glad we never had Reagan. You may or may not know this. It was one of his favorite shows.
No, I did not know that.
Reagan
wow.
had tried once upon a time to see if, could I be a guest on Family Ties?
Wow.
And I'm glad it didn't work out because to me, when you always have to reach out to someone like that, it feels like, is our show failing that badly that we have to bring in
big guns
yeah. like this to prop us up? The answer was no,
never.
We weren't failing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something terribly, terribly improbable about the President of the United States showing up in a living room in Columbus, Ohio. come on, of an average yeah. American family.
Stretch, a bit
yeah,
of a
exactly.
stretch.
It just made no sense to me, so I'm yeah. glad it never worked out.
Yeah.
Anyway.
The spirit was
but
there.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
spirit
but
was there.
They tried.
Actor Michael Gross, thank you for hanging out in studio.
An absolute pleasure.
And
thank
enjoy
you.
Your time in Chicago.
I always do.
Dave Plyer's radio special, Totally the 80s, continues.
Alan has spent decades in film, TV, and on stage. Some of Alan's most memorable roles include Cameron Frye in John Hughes' film Ferris Bueller's Day Off, as well as television roles as Stewart on the ABC sitcom Spin City, and of course, Connor Roy on the HBO series Succession, the latter earning him a Primetime Emmy and Golden Globe nomination, and part of the cast win for the Screen Actors Guild Award for Outstanding Performance by an Ensemble. He's a Midwest guy that spent his college years at the University of Illinois, and after graduation, moved up to Chicago. And to talk about it all is Alan Ruck. Alan, welcome in.
Hey, how are you?
I am great. Hitting the road, talking to audiences about this classic film and screening it, it's something you've enjoyed, haven't you?
Yeah. It's kind of amazing to me that after all these years, people still enjoy this movie. And the truth is, I've watched it a few times now, and it holds up.
It does hold up.
Yeah. And so I think a lot of John Hughes stuff holds up, and I know that Bueller holds up very well. So I'm really happy to be part of something that people still enjoy. They enjoyed when it came out, and then younger people have discovered it along the way. So it's very easy to be me. I'm a lucky guy.
You're a lucky guy. I was going to say, it was definitely a growing up film for me, getting out of high school, going to college and so forth. But then my kids have discovered it. And you're right about the different generations, especially so many of these John Hughes films. And for those of us living into Chicago, they're important movies to us.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, John, he loved Chicago with his whole heart, I think all of his films are kind of a love letter to Chicago, and Ferris Bueller definitely is. I mean, just, all the different places we go in the movie, it's a celebration of what a great town it is. I mean,
Absolutely
a fabulous
true.
Place to live, and I was lucky to live there for 5 years. I got out of school at the U of I, and I came right up to Chicago, and that's where I got started. That's where everything started for me.
What neighborhood did you live in when you moved here?
All over the North Side. I lived, my first apartment was on Armitage.
Oh, yeah.
Near Sheffield.
Okay.
But it wasn't so fancy back then.
Okay, fair enough.
It's definitely moved up, that neighborhood. But this is quite a while ago. This is 1979, 1980. But that was my first apartment. And then I lived in, Uptown, my friends and I rented out half of a duplex. It was the nicest place I ever lived in Chicago. Half of a duplex on Junior Terrace was the name of the street. And it was, we were just a block from the lake. And Uptown at that point was still a little tough.
Yeah.
You know, a little tough, but we lived in a very nice block in a very nice apartment. And then I lived way up in Rogers Park.
Very good. Very, very good. Well, you know, I was going to say, you know, this movie and most of the cast didn't think it was going to be a hit at the time. I mean, you guys were talking about it, like, yeah, we saw the screening. Yeah, maybe all the soundtrack parts weren't put into this thing yet. Not sure.
We weren't sure. I mean, but actors, you know, I mean, when you show an actor a movie, like the first time they see themselves in whatever movie they worked on, all that actor is going to be thinking about is their performance and basically doing a post-mortem. Like, yeah. I shouldn't have done that. I should have done this. Right. Why did I make that face? Is that really what I look like when I walk? You know, I mean, just we're a self-involved bunch.
maybe a little.
You know, as a general rule.
Yeah.
So the first time I saw it, it was, you know, the soundtrack was not sweetened. All the music was not in there. And I saw it with Mia and Jennifer Grey and Jeffrey Jones was there. And we saw a rough cut of it. And we were all kind of mortified. You know, we just wow. didn't know what to make of it. But this was... That movie didn't come out until June, late June. And this was like in March sometime we saw it. And it was still, you know, it was not completely put together. But so we had no idea. We just thought, well, better luck next time.
Well, what's funny about that is like really earlier in your career, you see how much, you know, a team effort is made to put a movie together, right? The soundtrack is so important. The editing is so important. And
everything,
right? Yeah.
It takes a huge group of people with entirely different skill sets to put a motion picture together. And it's one of my favorite places to be in the world. I mean, this is my top three. In bed with my wife. We don't have to be making out. Just in bed with my wife.
Yeah.
That's number one, you know.
Yeah.
Number two is doing anything with my kids, hopefully with all four of them together. That's the best.
Yeah, it's important.
And my third favorite place to be in the world is on a film set, but not any film set, a film set where I have a part to play.
Yeah, no
question. Because I go visit my wife, you know, when she does things, and everybody's really nice to me, but I don't belong there. You know, it's not, I don't have a job to do.
Oh,
but
you visit your wife. That's great.
Yeah,
that's great. Yeah,
but a film set is a wonderful business to be in, and it takes so many different people with so many different talents to put the whole thing together. I was lucky to fall into it, you know, and I enjoy it to this day.
Do you remember the audition for the movie for Ferris Bueller?
Yeah, I do. I had actually met John, in probably like 1982 or 83 in Chicago. He was going to do The Breakfast Club as kind of an indie. And I went in and I auditioned for Bender, you know, for the Judd Nelson part at that point. And then during that week, he met Molly Ringwald and he put The Breakfast Club on the back burner and he wrote 16 Candles for her over a weekend. That's how fast he was.
I know.
And and so then, of course, that happened. And then The Breakfast Club. And then by the time Bueller happened, he'd already done Pretty in Pink. That was in the can. And so I was in New York. I was working on Broadway with Broderick. And I went and I auditioned for the casting directors because they were a little worried about my age. And I went in, they're like, oh, yeah, he looks really young. And then my next audition was with Matthew for John Hughes. And so,
wow.
I mean, Matthew and I had just spent 6 months together.
Biloxi Blues, right?
On the road in a play. Yeah. And so we were already pals and we shared a similar sense of humor. And then I had known John a little bit, just, you know, it wasn't the first time I met him. So it couldn't have been an easier audition. It was just, it was playtime, you know.
But
it was joyous.
But you said how quickly these films get written. He wrote Bueller, I think, in less than a week, and he shot it. You guys shot it in 3 months. And you were mentioning your age, 29, playing a teenager, and I want to say that's pretty typical in Hollywood. Like Henry Winkler was 28 when he played the Fonz, when he was supposed to be a teenager. But that works, and it works in a lot of films.
Well, I mean, it worked for me at that time because I truly looked like I didn't look fully formed. You know, I didn't look fully human. Okay. I definitely didn't look like a 29-year-old man. But I think these days, I think they tend to cast teenagers as teenagers. I don't think they do the
it's true.
The older actor thing anymore.
It's different now.
But it doesn't matter because I am definitely no longer a teenage actor.
That's right. You are not.
Things have changed.
You know, I dug up the fact you were mentioning Matthew and Jennifer Grey. I dug up a fact that really surprised me. That I literally, like, I feel like I know a lot about these movies. And during the filming, there was, like, love all over the set. Like, Matthew Broderick, Jennifer Grey, who played his sister, by the way, got engaged before the movie's release. And then Ferris's parents met on the set of the movie, and they got married and had kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Wild.
Lyman Ward and Cindy Pickett. Yeah. Terrific people. Very funny. Wonderful people. And I mean, you know, I mean, as is true in Hollywood, they weren't nearly old enough to have
parents like that, right?
Maybe teenage kids, but definitely not old enough to be Broderick's parents. But because I think Cindy was still in her 30s. I think she was in her like mid 30s. And when Matthew made the movie, I think he was 23 or 24. But anyway,
yeah, that's funny.
Movie magic.
I love that. Well, we will talk a lot more about Ferris, and there's more with Alan next on 720 WGN. All right, we're talking to actor Alan Ruck, HBO Succession, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. So you got into the acting business. You know, you were seriously like in school, and I read this about you, miserable in school, had trouble concentrating, not that much into sports, and you really wanted to find some kind of identity for yourself. So where did acting come into play? Like, why was that the place?
Well, my older sister, my high school had a really good theater department. Mm-hmm. And a working class suburb. I mean, not a fancy suburb, working class, but there was a lot of money for schools back then because there was so much industry. And this was right outside Cleveland, Ohio. We had steel mills and automobile plants and everything that goes along with those industries. So there were lots of jobs and lots of people working hard and paying taxes. And the politicians felt compelled to give the money back to the people in some way. They didn't want to, but they felt like they had to. Right. So the way they did it was education. So we had a school system with every sports team you can imagine, every music program you can imagine, every after-school club. And unfortunately, my high school has just been torn down, my old high school.
Isn't that a bummer? Mine too, actually.
It was only 70 years old. It was a beautiful old building. But it had never been properly maintained. And anyway, long story, that's a whole nother story. But we had two theaters. We had an auditorium and we had a smaller theater that sat about 300 people. And as an English elective, you could take an acting class and you could also take play production classes. And when you were a senior, you could take something called arts seminar, where you studied art history, music history, and theater history. And my sister had been in plays before me. She was 4 years older than me. I watched her do that, and I just somehow, you know, I was maybe like 11 or 12 at the time. I watched her do that stuff, and I just kind of put it in my hip pocket. I just thought, I think I can do that. Mm-hmm. Wow. And then, you know, I went through the whole junior high misery. And
it is misery.
Like you mentioned, I was not any kind of an athlete. I couldn't concentrate. Puberty really messed me up with academics. And I just had no identity. I just didn't know who I was. And you know, you could become invisible pretty quickly in sort of the high school, junior high school culture. And so then when I found acting, I took that first acting class and I just knew I was home. I just knew that was it.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and then you went to University of Illinois, so back to Chicago, you know, for your BFA. And I just had I had Dan Aykroyd on recently, and I had read once that you got to watch the Blues Brothers being filmed when you lived here.
I mean, it was maybe the first month. It had to be the first month that I was in Chicago. So this was like September of 79, something like that. And not far from where I was living, I was walking somewhere. I don't know where I was going or what I was doing. But I looked across, which was kind of like a park. Or it seemed like it was baseball fields in my memory. And I saw a guy in sunglasses and a black hat walking along with some other dude who had like really long hair and a mustache. And some other guy in the street said, "Hey, that's Dan Aykroyd." And they were just grabbing. I don't even know if they had a permit to do it, but knowing those Blues Brothers guys, maybe they just were stealing a scene. Yeah, but it was Dan Aykroyd and some other actor some, you know, people with a camera, and they were just grabbing some footage of them walking along, you know, in Chicago. That's and funny. Immediately I was like, "Oh my God.
Yeah.
They make movies here.
Yeah.
They make movies here."
Yeah.
Yeah. And Blues Brothers really opened it up for Chicago, because the Hollywood people came and they saw this beautiful city, really photogenic city. And a lot of commercials were being shot there at the time. So there were all the equipment houses you could ever need, all the crew people you could ever need, the labs to develop the film. Everything was right there.
Yeah.
And then there's a huge theater scene in Chicago. All these actors who were available to play all the small parts, so they didn't have to bring everybody in from New York or Los Angeles. So it was a find for Hollywood.
Sure.
And that opened it up. And for about the next 10 years, Chicago was a go-to film location town.
Yeah, we still are. I mean, we really still are. And it's funny.
Well, I know you guys make a lot of TV shows there.
Yeah,
now.
We do. It's more TV than movies. You're absolutely right. But, you know, it was like back in then, and just a little history here, but like back in the early 1900s, there was no Hollywood. We were making – all the movies were being made here, and Charlie Chaplin was making movies here until they said, "Hey, we can't film from November pretty much through the end of March. We got to go somewhere warm." And
right.
But it took them almost 80 years to shoot back over here, you know?
Well, but you got him back, and that's the main thing.
We got him back. We absolutely got him back. We are talking to Alan Ruck. There's more with Alan after the news next here on 720 WGN. So, Succession, what an incredible, amazing, meaty role for you.
I know. It's funny because when I auditioned for that show, the email that they sent over from the agency said, "Not in line to inherit the company. This part will grow over time." And I thought, well, you know, that's good enough for me.
And it's intriguing. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I got the job, and then the first season, very exciting. And I had some stuff to do. And then in the second season, the truth is there was so much story to tell. And the story was called Succession. It was not called the brain-damaged, mopey older guy, you know. This story was mostly about Logan and then, you know, the golden trio of Kendall and Roman and Siobhan and, you know, all the other sort of vultures hanging around waiting to see, you know, who is going to get the keys to the kingdom. So in the second season, I didn't have a lot to do. And my ego got in the way, and I got a little downhearted, you know. And what really kind of sealed it for me was I was out here in L.A. I wasn't needed in New York, so I came home. And some friend of a friend said, "Oh, dude, there's this show. I bet you would love it. It's called Succession." And I said, "Yeah, yeah, I'm on that show." And this guy says, "Oh, you wish." And I said, "No, I'm on that show." And this guy said, "No, you're not. I haven't seen you on it."
Yeah.
And I guess he came into it, you know, like at the beginning of the second season or whatever. So I got really bummed out. And I actually went to our head writer and our top director. And I said, "You guys, why don't you kill me off?" I said, you know, somebody's got to die, right? Somebody's got to die in a show like this. I said, why didn't you kill me off, you know? And thankfully, and I am, you know, grateful forever, they said, no, we need you. Don't worry. There's nothing right now, but there will be stuff for you down the road. And true to their word, you know, they delivered.
Absolutely so. Did. Absolutely did. I was going to say, the show is so incredibly deep, but there's so often I laughed out loud watching miserable people that are dysfunctional with money. That's fun.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it is good sport. It's one of the greatest indoor sports there is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, like, you know, some shows, you know, provide a little more freedom when developing a character, like very early on. Did you have that freedom? Did producers welcome that, or did you kind of work in tandem with each other?
Yeah, Jesse Armstrong is brilliant, and he, our head writer and creator, and he hired the most glorious bunch of people populate his writer's room. They were all award-winning playwrights and people who had developed shows on their own in the States and in England. And, you know, I would come up with ideas and I'd bounce them off. And Jesse was always like, interesting, you know, let's have a think about that. He would say, let's have a think about that. And and I was free to create my own backstory. I mean, Jesse would drop little hints along the way. You know, he'd say, I don't think Connor's mother is on the planet anymore. So, but he didn't go into too much detail. And then there would be a line like, oh, Roman said in one episode about my mom, oh, boo-hoo, mommy's in the crazy house or something like that. So there were little hints along the way. And what you do as an actor is you take all these hints from the writers and then you fill in the gaps with your imagination. And you come up with the story you need to, you know, make yourself believe what you're doing in any given scene.
Love that. I love hearing that. I love hearing that for sure. You talked about the exceptional writer's room, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. You had an exceptional ensemble that co-starred with you, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God. I was just – they're all off right now. I'm in Los Angeles. My wife is actually in New York working on a movie, but most of my castmates – are scattered around the globe working on plays. Wow. Jeremy, I don't know if they're still running, but he just did, it might still be going, the Enemy of the People in New York City. Brian Cox is doing Long Day's Journey Into Night in London. Sarah Snook is doing a play about a one-woman show about Oscar Wilde. She plays 26 different characters.
Oh my God.
She's doing that in London right now. Wow. And then my other pals, Jay Smith Cameron is going to go off to London in the fall to work opposite Mark Rylance in a play called Juno and the Paycock. I mean, and a whole bunch of other folks in New York, just, you know.
You're staying connected. I can tell.
They're just, yeah, it's great. I mean, we are staying connected and people are just getting real busy. They're doing a lot of theater right now. An amazing group of people, and like down to the smallest part. I mean, we live, you know, we shot mostly in New York City, and you know, I mean, there's just all these fabulous theater actors that live there, and we just had our pick of the litter. You know, we just had like the best people we could possibly find were available. It was lucky again.
You've had a great career karma. So far, my friend. Yes, you have. Yes, you have. Dave
Pryor, WGN. One of the biggest hits on TV toward the end of the decade was The Wonder Years. For six seasons, this 80s comedy captured the angst in growing up in suburban middle-class America in the 1960s, as seen through the life and times of Kevin Arnold. It won an Emmy, a Peabody, and a Golden Globe for Best Series and starred Chicago's very own Fred Savage.
Fred, how are you, pal?
I'm great. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and particularly a pleasure to talk to WGN. It's always great to talk to you guys.
That's awesome. Well, you're talking about growing up in Glencoe, so you spent a good chunk of your early life here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I lived on Park Avenue in Glencoe, and grew up in the same house my dad grew up in.
Oh, that's cool.
Until I was about probably 13 or 14 years old.
So when you were doing movies and television in the early years, you were just out there for the season and you would come back here and this was still home for you.
Oh yeah. No, absolutely. I would go, you know, to location or to LA or to Vancouver or to wherever the work was, wherever the job was, and then I would always come back home to Glencoe.
So what took you out to California? At what point in your life did your folks say, hey, you know, this kid's talented, or did you say, hey, you know, I really want to do this? How did you make it out to California to try your way in acting?
Well, I started acting when I was in Chicago. I mean, I started doing commercials downtown, and I did a whole bunch of movies when I was young, when I was still living in Chicago. So, I moved out to Los Angeles once the Wonder Years started. We shot the pilot of the Wonder Years, came back to L.A., and then our first season was short. Our first season was 6 episodes. And I came, to L.A. for that, and then I went back. And then as my family started to realize it was going to be a longer-term commitment, we started to slowly relocate out here. But it wasn't until the Wonder Years was kind of up and running that we relocated.
Now, you were mentioning you did a bunch of television shows. You did like a reboot of The Twilight Zone. You did Crime Story. I remember you on Crime Story. But the first big film you did was The Princess Bride, wasn't it?
Yeah, I did one movie before that when I was really young, when I was about 8 years old, called The Boy Who Could Fly.
Oh, right.
And then Princess Bride was the movie I did right after that one.
Okay. Now, I know you did a movie with Judge Reinhold called Vice Versa.
We actually shot in Chicago.
And you shot it here.
Yeah.
I remember The Princess Bride, too, had all kinds of your bedroom, had all kinds of Chicago stuff around it. So Chicago has kind of followed you.
Yes, so it has. And that was actually because I wish I could say that was my doing. I mean, I loved it. But, William Goldman, who wrote the book that the movie was based on, is a Chicago guy. And so all of those Chicago elements that were on the set were in the original book.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Well, this Vice Versa, that's how you got a casting director saw you in Vice Versa, and that's kind of how you got the Wonder Years gig?
Yes, that's exactly how that came about. Okay. I'd done this film called Vice Versa, and actually the creators of the Wonder Years, a couple in a writing team named Carol Black and Neil Marlins, they saw that movie and had their casting directors contact us and say, we thought you'd be great for the show.
That's awesome. I'm a little bit older than you, but I grew up in the late 70s watching Happy Days and stuff. And this Wonder Years was really the next generation of those shows. It was really a look back at a fonder, simpler time of life. It was so well done, so well written, so well put together. It was really one of the first single camera comedies that are out there, which are so common now.
It was definitely, it certainly wasn't the first by any stretch, but at that time there weren't many out there, and so it was kind of a unique way visually to tell the story, and I think really helped embrace and encapsulate kind of the nostalgia of that era.
You really grew up on this show. What do you remember about the early days? Because you were pretty young.
I have nothing but positive memories of doing that show. I remember it was very sad leaving my friends. It was hard to leave Chicago. But I had just a great time. I loved being in LA. I loved working on the show. It was just nothing but kind of positive memories.
There was something I read, and you say that, and you said it was just a great set. People respected that there were kids on the set, which is so incredibly important. But I read an interview in Esquire where you talked about an episode where the folks had a party and the adults were playing Twister. And you got a little more than you were bargained for there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, we did, we worked on that show for 6 years, or maybe a little bit more even, and did, over 100 episodes. So, I mean, anytime you get that many people working together for that many years, there's, things are bound to happen. But
sure.
It was definitely a really positive, really friendly set and a great place to grow up.
Yeah. And, I would assume could have been your first kiss on air in life, too, within...
This is true.
Yeah.
This is true.
I would think so with Danica McKellar, who's just lovely. Any favorite episodes from back then that you fondly look on and say, gosh, that was a fun show to do? Do you ever see the shows? Do you ever watch them with your kids?
My kids just started watching the episodes, actually, with my my mom started showing them.
That's awesome.
To them recently, in the last few weeks. So yeah. That's been a new thing. And to see them enjoy it and to see them talk about it as much as they are and really react to it and respond to it, see this next generation really embrace the show has been thrilling for me. And you know, particularly being my own kids, it's even more exciting.
Well, some of the shows that are on for young people, I got two young kids. I have three young kids, actually, but one's really young, that watch some of the Disney Channel and Nickelodeon stuff. And, you know, not all of it is great quality. So I like it when they throw on a classic program, whether it's from the 70s or the 80s that, you know, and this one's pretty timeless because it takes place in a certain era. It takes place in the 1960s. So it really never gets old because when you're watching it. But the kids always relate to those situations of getting the girl and dealing with a difficult teacher or dad's coming home, which would be me, a little irritable tonight. But it's just one of those shows that I think everyone's got some kind of connection to, no matter what area you grew up in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that made this show so great then and so timeless is that it really does kind of address universal questions, problems, moments in adolescence that we've all experienced, whether you grew up you know, in the 60s or the 90s or today, or whether you grew up in the United States or across the world, that people have really responded to it. Because I think there are those kind of transcendent moments in growing up that everyone can relate to and experience.
And you've been doing this for so long, and, you know, you're producing, you're directing now. So you see some of these shows. Back then, and we're talking 80s, 90s, but really there's not a lot of shows that had closure. And, you know, I know you get asked all the time about reunions and stuff, and this is one show where there was really full-on closure when the show ended. You knew where the cast, you know, the characters were going after the show ended. I don't know how you could go back and do, unless you were just hanging out on the set of like Fallon's Tonight Show or something like that. But to go back and do so, I think the show ended how it began. It was just a great story that just kind of, you know, made you think about, you know, another era.
I'm glad you feel that way. Thank you.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. You've continued acting over the years, but you really got your hands in directing and producing. What made you go to the other side of the camera?
You know, directing was something I'd wanted to do ever since I was a kid. You know, when I was on The Wonder Years, I would look at the directors and always wonder, you know, how they made the choices they made and why they placed the camera in one part of the room as opposed to another. And I was just always fascinated with kind of that art of filmmaking, of, you know, behind a television show. And so it was something I had always, you know, it was a dream I always harbored and something I always wanted to do. And, you know, as I got older, I was, you know, I was able to get those opportunities. And I, you know, like I said, it was something I'd always wanted to do. And I couldn't be more thrilled that I've been able to build this directing career. It's probably the thing I'm most proud of, just because it was something I really always wanted to do and really put my mind to it and worked hard and was able to achieve it.
Such a multi-talented guy. You know, have you found real joy in doing things behind the camera and doing the producer and director, or do you like being in front of the camera? Like, what do you prefer a little bit more? Like, what do you really get your heart pumping?
Well, I love working in the television industry. I mean, in comedy in particular. I mean, it's what I grew up doing. It's what I love doing. So to be able to really get to my heart pumping is to know that I'm still working in an industry that's given me so much pleasure and joy and support, you know, all these years later. I mean, to longevity in any career is not something you can take for granted, and particularly not in show business.
Especially when you start so young. Yeah, especially when you start.
Yeah, so the fact that I'm continuing to do it and continuing to get the opportunities to kind of reinvent myself and approach things in different ways at different times of my life, That's really what I'm most excited about.
Dave Plyer's radio special, Totally the 80s, continues.
All right, back in 1971, a young Martha Davis joined the Warfield Foxes, a band from Berkeley, California. In 1975, they moved to Los Angeles and changed the band's name to The Motels. The Motels released five albums on Capitol Records between 79 and 85, two of them earning gold record status and generating two top 10 singles, Only the Lonely and Suddenly Last Summer. Have been recording and touring ever since. And joining us is Martha Davis from The Motels. Welcome in, Martha.
Well, it's very nice to be here. And where am I?
You're in Chicago here. And where are you?
Hi, Chicago. I love Chicago. I'm glad I know where I am now. I thought I was in my bedroom. I don't know.
What was your first time in Chicago, like performing? Do you remember?
Oh, God. That was about 10 billion years ago, so not necessarily. I just know that I love Chicago. Chicago was always, I hate to say it, I don't know. And why do they call Chicago a town? It kind of looks like a city to me. But
yeah, it's a city of Chicago, but it's that toddling town.
But it's town.
Sinatra that did that, yeah.
And not only that, that's why I love it, because it feels like a town. It feels, New York's too much for me, but Chicago's just right.
Yeah, so we've got little neighborhoods, and they feel like little communities, and I think that's what...
Wonderful food and wonderful art and wonderful climate, unless you're there when the hawk is out, and then you're kind of...
So let's go back a bit. I know you started taking guitar lessons at like 8 years old, which means you've been playing guitar for over six decades, which is wild.
Well, let's clarify that.
Okay, all right.
I was taught three chords by my babysitter, the one, you know, A, E, and G, E and D, and that kept me going until I was about 18, and I did, that's, it took me till 18 to learn to bar a chord. I am not really your, like, you know, I'm not Segovia over here.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, my babysitter, which I have to have a nod out to. My babysitter was a young African American man going to Cal Berkeley on a scholarship. When he graduated, his first job, he was in the law department. He went to law school there, and his first job when he graduated was working for Bobby Kennedy in the,
Wow.
Yeah. That was his first job. He's the Honorable Judge Felton Henderson, who has retired now, but we still stay in touch. And amazing, amazing man. So
yeah, that's very, very cool. Yeah. Well, then how did music really come into your life? I know you've talked about in the past having, you know, your mother had a large record collection that you could peruse and kind of go through. But what really inspired you to get into this?
Well, I feel like I remember being about 5 years old and sitting in front of the turntable watching it spin around, and it was going fast because they were 78s. Yeah. Yes, I'm incredibly old. My mom had a great collection, and she was, you know, older than me. Anyway, so the first record that just like knocked my socks off as a 5 year old was The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky.
Oh, wow.
And that piece of music, just like, I would sit there and just stare at the turntable, and I'd be frightened, and I'd be in love, and it was just like such an emotional piece of music, and I always, always have loved that. And that might be where my first twisted start in music began. But then she also had a wonderful blues collection, and she had the first songs that I ever played live, which was in the fourth grade. On stage, I played spirituals. So there you go. I loved that music more than anything. So my first love was, I think I played Sweet Chariot and We Must Walk This Lonesome Valley.
You know, it's really interesting, too, because, like, I think even those of us who didn't get into the music scene or form a band, I think we, you know, there's a generation out there that got into music in general by going through their parents' record collection and putting it on the turntable. Yeah.
Absolutely. And she had so many different kinds. You know, I also, you know, Tom Lehrer, I don't know if you know about Tom Lehrer, but he was this insane piano player, math teacher, I think it was Harvard or something, but the rhyme master of all time. I think you may know Rickety Tickety Tin, or, yeah, okay, that's Tom Lehrer. And I think I got a lot of rhymey quality from him.
All right. Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, even more, you know, before the Motels, you know, it was the early 70s, 1971 specifically, was kind of the beginning of the band, which was called the Warfield Foxes. How did that form? How did that all come about?
Well, the name, I think, was taken from the Fox Warfield, which was a theater in Oakland. Mm. So I think that we just thought we were real smart by becoming the Foxes, you know, because that's what you called pretty people back in the day, was Foxer.
Sure.
Yeah. Foxy lady. So that was clever of us. And then we had the most crazy band, the Warfield Foxes was Dean Chamberlain, Chuck Wada, Lisa Brennis, and myself. There wasn't really a drummer. The boys took turns, like, sort of playing drums. The music was kind of, and one of these days I'm going to put out some of this archival stuff because it's hilarious.
Yeah.
It was kind of a weird funk band. I don't know. It was very strange. There was, and Chuck was one of the main writers. I had a few songs in there, but Chuck was like, and he had such wonderful hits as "Hey Baby, Bend Over." So I don't know. It was very, and "Hearse Girl," and you know, it was hilarious. So maybe someday those will see the light of day.
I love that. I love that. I was gonna say, trying to hit the scene with a new group and in the early days, you know, and it was while you were a young mom. I mean, so, you know, talk about like trying to kickstart like something brand new and something like that, that you're performing at night and you got to work really hard to get noticed in the music business. I mean, that must have been a pretty interesting time.
It's not a good match for motherhood. Neither is getting pregnant when you're 15, but that's what happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I dare say, as much as I adore my children, I've already lost one to a fentanyl overdose and just recently.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
My other daughter doesn't speak to me. So as much as there were times when we had wonderful times, it was really hard. And I think it was really hard on them. It's just most of the time I would think that was because more than anything, I was terrified most of the time. And that's not a good thing to pass on to your children. You know, anxiety is never a healthy emotion. And I never knew if we were going to eat. I never knew where we were going to, you know, my parents had both died as well. So right. There was no net beneath me. I was just free falling. And the only thing I knew I could potentially do after dropping out of school in the ninth grade was music. That was the passion, and that and art. I love to draw and paint and stuff. But
you know, it's funny though, like when traumatic things happen to you, and you hear this from comedians all the time, like from trauma, you know, and drama comes comedy. And that's really a big, you know, thread in the music industry as well, is, you know, you find your creativity when you have to let something out.
Well, it's not only that. When I got into music, I was one of the most terrified, paranoid. I mean, not paranoid, but just so shy, so painfully shy. I was afraid to call a department store to see how late they'd be open because I was afraid to talk to a stranger. You know, I was just like, I was a freak. And this is very common, and especially in music and performers, because the first time we performed was in a place called Project Artaud on Halloween night in 1971, was it? Yeah, I think. And it was an artist commune, and it was a freak show, and it was Halloween night, and I just remember I was terrified, and I didn't want to go on, and then they said, well, if we don't go on right now, we're going to lose our place, because it was kind of a free-for-all, and we got to get our gear up there and do it, and like, I don't, and then somebody gave me a shot of Southern Comfort, and like, I'm scared, I can't, and all of a sudden, like, moments before I went on, I just went, we gotta go on. And something possessed me. And then I got on stage, and as long as I was singing the songs and performing, I was an animal. I scared me. I was like, I was going up and staring people in the face. I was dropping to my knees. I was like, what the hell is going on? It was terrifying. But what was happening is like the inner crazy person was merging with the shy person. And now I think we don't know where one starts and the other one stops. But it was, and as the years have gone by, I mean, I was terrified through most of it, but now, because I'm a 73-year-old feisty old woman, I am actually having the time of my life. I'm probably happier now than I ever have been.
I love hearing that. Well, you know, and again, those early days, the band changed to the Motels. And what was the why the Motels?
excellent name thought of by Dean Chamberlain, who was at that time thinking we should call ourselves the Angels of Mercy. And I was like, not unless we're passing out soup and blankets. Come on. Mm. It's like, that's just... And we were driving to our first gig at Barney's Beanery in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. down on Santa Monica Boulevard. And at that point, Santa Monica Boulevard was not what it is today, which is a very happy place. It was where all the motels were. And so I was arguing about the name Angels of Mercy, and Dean looks up and says, what about the motels? And I went, I knew I loved you. That was it. And we literally walked in, and the guy, the announcer's like, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the Angels. I'm like, no, it's the motels. It was so. That was cool. When it got decided. And they paid us in tokens for hamburgers.
Oh, my goodness. That's how a lot of – I heard that from a lot of bands that started. Mm-hmm. They fed you. That's how you got paid. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. My conversation with Martha Davis of the Motels will continue right after this on 720 WGN.
All right, we are talking to Martha Davis of 80s Rockers, The Motels. All right, you performed for a while, and then in 1979, Mother's Day, actually, you got signed with Capitol Records. You must have been over the top. That was a big deal.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And it was interesting because at that point, which was really sad for a lot of bands, there was a coked out feeding frenzy going on in Hollywood, probably everywhere. Where the record companies had just found out that, you know, whoa, maybe there, I think the Knack started it, God bless them. And they went, wow, maybe there's talent right here, because they were basically going to New York to sign punk bands and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was we were in that really weird thing where we weren't punk, but we weren't, you know, mainstream.
Right, right.
We were just a really odd creature. And so, like, all these bands were just getting signed up by all the record companies. And there was... We got offered, I mean, I talked to a lot of different record companies, but Capitol was there from the beginning.
Right.
And Capitol was actually there. John Carter, who was our first producer, saw the band when we were first moved down to Hollywood, and we were playing at the Starwood, and somebody, even one of the guys that worked there, says, there's a producer, there's a guy here from Capitol Records. He wants to talk to you. And I'm like, oh my God. And so I go over and meet him. I'm so nervous. I think I dropped a glass of red, white wine in his lap or something stupid. But then I went backstage and sit to tell the guys, Capitol Records is interested in making some demos with us or doing something. And Robert, the drummer at the time, said, well, I quit, which is what happens so many times with bands. So it was a start over. But when it came time in 79, Carter was there again. And that kind of like, that company was so wonderful at that time and so devoted. And I mean, we made 3 albums that never did anything,
right.
Nothing, zip. Zip. Total Control did something in Australia, but you had to go around the world to get to the success. But they stuck with us, and that was when record companies used to have a thing called artist development.
Right, right.
It's an antiquity right now, but we were lucky to be there then.
Well, it was the same time, too, around the late 70s, that they made a big deal about women doing rock music and getting signed. And what was that like for you? Did you care? Did that matter to you, or was it just about making music?
It was very irritating. It's
what's
it like to be a woman in rock? I go, it's like being anybody in rock. That's right. Are you good? Great. Can you write a song? Can you? Do you have talent? If you don't, it doesn't matter if you're a woman or a man.
That's true.
Go away.
That's
if
true.
You do. Try to stay.
That's right. That's absolutely.
And you have to try to stay. It's not easy. This is not a sport for the weak of heart, you know.
Well, you said too, the first few albums, you know, did some things overseas and so forth. But you know, your band style of music did change over those years. And All for One was that first U.S. hit album for the Motels, and it was the best selling album. So the first single from was Only the Lonely, which reached number 9 on the Hot 100, 27 on Adult Contemporary, as well as number 6 on the Top Tracks. I mean, that was a big time. Did you, like, after recording a few albums, you said you got to stick to it. It's not for the weak of heart. So when this next album came out, where you were like, finally, you know, getting some recognition here.
Yes and no. I mean, it's a double-edged sword, because I am a wacky person that likes really strange music. I have never been as wacky as I'd like to be, which we're getting close to that now, because we have a new album on the way.
Okay, good here. Okay.
Very wacky. So the middle of the road MOR sound of the All for One album was not my favorite. And the process of making that album was pretty torturous. And so Only the Lonely Can Play is a little telling about that whole situation. There was a lot of angst and, you know, it was not an easy time. We were very happy to find some recognition and some money, and, you know, all those things. Because it costs a lot to do music. It costs so much money to do music, and just the gear and the rehearsals and
writing
this.
And everything.
But, you know, it's not cheap. And you're always like, you know, and the funny thing is like anything else, is like if you don't have anything, you get nothing.
Sure.
If you get signed and all of a sudden you've got money, people want to give you everything. And it's like, how is that fair? It's just not fair. We could have really used that gear when we were struggling.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, so, but you know, that album allowed it did a lot of things. Not all of them good. I think one of the things it did was I started feeling that I was leaving where I wanted to go artistically, you know, so I was getting a little more frustrated. It was not a real happy time for me, to be perfectly honest.
That's wild, because I was going to say, like, you know, after that album, I mean, it was, you know, maybe second year of MTV and the music videos were out there. I mean, you were one of the first on MTV, you know, won American Music Awards for that. And then Little Robbers came around in 83, suddenly last summer, you know, number 9. But, you know, those were big moments, but you're saying...
They were, but you know, they're even bigger now when they get like played on like Mr. Robot and and the Bear, and you know, they're still going. Those two songs are still going.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Suddenly Last Summer, I think, has been in Sopranos, Breaking Bad. Let's see, what was the other? American Horror Story.
That's cool.
Mr. Robot. You know, Mr. Robot was Total Control. And Total Control's done something wild. I mean, and I still hear them, you know, when
Isn't
I go
that
to
great?
The street. Yeah, that's the good part. That to me is like, because I'm not about, you know, fame. I'm about being a writer and seeing if my stuff is actually going to stand the test of time. That's the real accolade. That's the payback.
What a very cool conversation, and I'm just thrilled that you just sound like you're having a really great time, and I can't wait to see you on stage.
I am truly having a wonderful time, and this was a continued wonderful time. Thank you so much, Dave. This was great.
Thank you, Martha.